Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Sharon Short.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Sharon, you've been writing books for what, 20 years?
Yes, at least. I've been writing since I was a kid, but yeah, I've been writing books as an adult for about 20 years.
First published book in 93?
93, correct.
Okay. Your new one is My One Square Inch of Alaska. And this is kind of a departure for you, isn't it?
It certainly is. My first nine books were mysteries and divided between two series. And this is a standalone coming-of-age, I guess, book club novel set in 1953 Ohio. So it's entirely different from the other books.
And why did you decide to write something different?
It was a story that kind of found me. I was at a book club meeting with some friends and discussing a book, not anything like this one. We were actually discussing a romance novel for fun around Valentine's Day. And one of the other ladies said, "Does anybody remember the deeds you could get in cereal boxes in the 50s to One Square Inch of Alaska?" And that was before my time. But the phrase "One Square Inch of Alaska" just resonated in my head. And as strange as it may sound, sort of in the midst of my imagination, this young woman and her little brother kind of showed up and peered at me and said, "Would you please tell our story about how we got our one square inch of Alaska?" And I don't remember the rest of the book club meeting because my imagination was gone. And by the time I got home, I'd actually written in my mind one of the final scenes. And I ran in the house and wrote it down in my journal. And it became one of the only two scenes that didn't require complete rewriting. It's almost exactly as I wrote it down. And at that point, I thought, all right, I have them in this final scene. What happened to get them there? So I kind of figured it out backwards. And by the time I'd done all that, I was in love with the story and the characters, and I just had to tell it. So I did.
Is that typical that you would have a final kind of scene that you would have to build the rest of the story to go toward?
That's the first time that's ever happened for me. And it was kind of a thrilling process to know this is what I'm driving toward, because that meant the characters had to be motivated to get there too. So it was a fun process.
Well, I love this title and I love the cover, My One Square Inch of Alaska. You have some great titles. Some of your other books have some very funny, catchy titles. Do you
true.
Get to come up with the title?
I do, yeah. The first three books in my second mystery series that weren't really my titles. I had different titles. But the last three books were my titles. So one of my favorite is Tie-Dyed and Dead. I think that's kind of a funny title. And Hung Out to Die, that's a funny title too. But this story sort of demanded the title, My One Square Inch of Alaska. There was no way it could be really called anything else. So I think it really fits the story and kind of captures what the story is about, which is finding your pursuing your one dream in this vast sort of world, you know, we live in. So
your storyteller in this one is a 17-year-old woman.
Mm-hmm.
She's just getting into her senior year in high school.
Yes.
She lives in this little town near Dayton, Ohio.
Yes.
And her family's kind of having some problems, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Mama's gone. Daddy is only semi-functioning and is alcoholic. Grandma's a real piece of work and isn't as supportive as she could be. Her little brother's the optimist in the whole bunch. And Donna's kind of taken on an adult role far beyond what she should have to do as a 17-year-old. But she does it not only for herself, but out of love for her little brother. And, of course, he has this dream. He's going to get this deed to One Square Inch of Alaska. And, by the way, in real life, those deeds, you simply pulled them out of a cereal box, which is not interesting. And they were also actually to One Square Inch of the Yukon Territory in real life. But everybody remembers it as being Alaska, which I think is really fascinating because I think it says something about what Alaska still represents to us in many ways, that it's the land where you can go and reinvent yourself and pursue your dreams. And he has this quest that he will save his tin box tops and write his essay and get his deed. And she sees it as kind of, you know, perhaps juvenile. But as she decides to help him, she becomes inspired to pursue her own dream, which is to become a designer, a fashion designer.
And like a lot of us who watched television in the 1950s, Will loves a particular program that's set in Alaska.
Uh-huh.
And I have fond memories of a program very much like that myself.
Oh, okay.
You remember Sergeant Preston?
That's what this show is based on, exactly.
Okay.
Yes. The TV show Sergeant Preston of the Wild, I believe. And he had his husky and went out in the Yukon Territory. And the cereal box promotion back then was not only for the cereal, but to promote the show, especially as it transitioned from TV or from radio to television. And so, yeah, I use that as a template for my version of it, which is Sergeant Stryker. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have fond memories of Saturday mornings with that program and
great.
Roy Rogers
mm-hmm.
and Sky King.
Mm-hmm.
That was a particular favorite.
That's right.
Sharon Short joins us. Her new novel is My One Square Inch of Alaska. Donna is very ambitious, but she's also a little naive.
Yes. Well, I think 17-year-olds kind of can be. It's an adult novel because of the point of view from which it's told. It's really told from an adult Donna looking back at this moment in time in her life and how it shaped her. But she is 17 and believes she can do things that, you know, an older person, you know, maybe in their 20s would say, no way, we're not going to get in the car and head across the country towards, you know, Alaska, as they eventually do. Or, you know, or I'm not going to make these decisions that are kind of dangerous at times. But I think certainly looking back, I wasn't a very wild teenager, but I was more likely to take on risk than I might be now. So I think it's pretty realistic.
And was your hometown in Dayton?
Yes, I grew up in Centerville.
Okay. And you're very involved in writing. Not only are you a writer, a very active writer, you're involved in all these book activities, and you're the director of the Antioch Writers Workshop.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is your life, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the world of story is definitely my life.
So we have this Rust Belt town.
Mm-hmm.
Donna is working really hard to get that nest egg so that she can get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
She has dreams of moving to the big city.
That's right.
And she finds these suitcases.
Yes. And they're filled with clothes that used to belong to her mother. And these clothes do not reflect her memory of her mother. She remembers her mother as sort of depressed and you know, not a particularly energetic, outgoing woman. But the clothes present a different mama. They present somebody who was vivacious and outgoing and embraced life. And she ends up remaking these clothes to do her own fashion design, because otherwise they're going to sit in these suitcases, and also she can't afford a ton of material. And so she sort of remakes these clothes to be her own, but in the process of doing so, starts to figure out some things about her mom.
And she works at the diner. That's one of her jobs.
Yes.
And she's a waitress, and her father's mother, her mm-hmm. grandmother, mm-hmm. owns the diner. And she's kind of the villain in the story, isn't she?
She kind of is, yeah. Dot's Corner Cafe is the diner, and Grandmother Dot, nothing like my grandmother's, just for the record. Gotta make that clear. I had very lovely grandmothers, especially my father's mother was a delightful woman. But yes, every story needs an antagonist, and probably she fulfills that role the most, because she wants Donna to be very conventional. She wants social status in a way that Donna is sort of bucking against. She wants Donna to toe the line and go with the handsome rich guy who's going to make things just so for Donna. And Donna doesn't want any of that. She wants to forge her own path.
And Grandma is absolutely tickled when the golden boy, the
mm-hmm.
son of the guy who runs the big company in town, the big factory,
right,
shows some interest in Donna. Suddenly, Grandma's like, oh, we got to do everything to make this possible. It's all about status, isn't it?
Exactly. That's exactly what Grandma represents. Yes.
So how did you get the sense of this little community in the early 50s before a lot of this manufacturing went away. And you've also got this subplot of problems at the factory.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get the plotting of this? And this guy who's kind of a derelict, who's wandering around the town, he's a very interesting character.
Oh, good. I'm glad you said that, because he's not often brought up, Eddie. Well, I grew up and came of age in the 70s in Dayton, but, you know, that was close enough to certainly people a generation older than me and their memories of when, you know, towns weren't called Rust Belt towns because they weren't thought of that way. And manufacturing towns were thought of as sort of meccas of, you know, you can get a job and you can take care of yourself and you can take care of your family. And it's always going to be this way and it's always going to be, you know, great. And so I partly wanted to go back to that time period for that reason. I wanted to go back to 1953 because it's a pretty interesting year. It's, you know, McCarthyism is in full swing. Unions are starting to come into their own, and there's some conflict there. And my father was a union leader, and I remembered hearing stories about, you know, his days as a union boss and what that was like. And I have a real affinity for small towns. Even though I live in the suburbs, I love small towns. And so I wanted to really get into the life of a small town, which I've done in other writing, but in this book. And it just sort of all made sense to set it in 1953. I never really saw myself as a historical writer, but, you know, you have to kind of pick the time that goes with the story. And you couldn't really write My One Square Inch of Alaska set in 2013. That wouldn't make sense, but it definitely made sense for 1953.
So are there always elements that bleed through a little bit? You just alluded to the fact that your dad was involved with union activity, mm-hmm. and that's how you had some of the knowledge about mm-hmm. how to put that in the story. Is there always some of that that comes through for you?
Oh, definitely. When I was younger, I wanted to be a writer, I mean, way younger, a writer, an artist, a musician, and a fashion designer. And that that speaks to, you know, that's the kind of will, like, I can do everything, I can do it all, and it'll be no problem. So I decided to pick on the fashion designer aspect for Donna, partially because that was something that I thought would be fun when I was a younger girl, but also because it's a way for her to get to know her mom. If her dream had been to be a lawyer, that would be perfectly fine, but she wouldn't have been that fascinated with the clothes, and the clothes seemed like a great way for her to get to know her mom. So, you know, there's a little bit of that. Certainly the emotional trajectory of, I think for any of us, of, you know, having a dream and wanting to pursue it. You know, I knew as a very young woman that what I really wanted to do was write. So I related to Donna in that way, and that sense of I'm going to do this somehow, no matter what. So I connected with her with that.
And I hate to call it a stereotype or a cultural cliche, but she has this art teacher who is like so many art teachers that we remember from
yes.
high school.
He's
someone who opens doors and shows kids in this little town, in this little high school, that mm-hmm. there's something bigger out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly had teachers like that in high school. I had a particular teacher who I told him I'd written a musical called Just an Old Ballad way before Smoke on the Mountain was at least in my knowledge around. And I said, you know, I wrote this musical and I want to produce it and I want to direct it. And will you help me? And he said, sure. And
wow.
He let me put on this musical. And actually, I ended up casting in the lead role the young man who would become my husband later.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm totally serious. My husband, David, yeah, I cast him in the lead role and we started dating. And so, you know, several years later, got married. So that's how I married my high school sweetheart.
So you went to high school with your husband?
I did. We actually traced it back and realized we were in the same elementary school together, but we didn't know each other at the time.
Wow. Sharon Short joins us. Her new novel is My One Square Inch of Alaska. And it should also be noted that Sharon and I have a common activity. We both write columns that appear on the same page in the newspaper.
That's
would you like
right.
to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I would love to. Yes, I write a column called Literary Life, and it's so much fun because I get to interview writers about their experiences. I get to talk to groups that are putting on poetry slams or story slams or write about workshops, not just the Antioch Writers Workshop, which is, if I can put in a little plug, a great workshop. But there are lots of other great writing events and reading events. And I get to interview authors that come to town. I don't review books. I leave that to experts other than me. But I do really enjoy talking to people who are living this literary life. And that's why it's called Literary Life. And I've been doing that since April of 2012. So it's a lot of fun.
A number of years ago, and I'm sure you remember this, Sue Grafton came to Antioch Writers Workshop. In fact, she came back again another mm-hmm. time, and that gave me an opportunity to have her on this program. And I understand that she's someone that you admire.
Oh, very much. Yes. I first came to the Antioch Writers Workshop back in 1990, which was the first year that Sue Grafton taught. She taught again in 95, and I believe she came back as a guest speaker in 2005. And she was, I think, five or six titles into her series in 1990. Fabulous teacher, and I had a critique with her. And it really shaped how I look at my own writing and how, if I'm ever asked to give a critique, I look at other people's writing, which is she looked at the manuscript for The Mystery I'd Written, which never got published and is fine. It was one of the novels I had to write to learn how to write a novel. But she was very wise. She pointed out, here's what you're doing well, and here's what you need to work on. And it just really resonated in my mind that, you know, we're all on this journey. We're just at different places in the journey. And no matter where you are on the journey, there are some things you're doing well and there's some things you need to work on. And 20 years later, I still feel that way about my writing. So, yeah, I very much admire Sue Grafton.
I think the thing I was most struck by with Sue is that she's just like a person that you would meet, your next-door neighbor, someone mm-hmm. from down the street. You would never know that she is Sue Grafton,
yeah.
best-selling author. She's
exactly.
just so rootsy.
Mm-hmm. She is. She's very down to earth and loves this writing life and you know, very encouraging of lots of people. I know I'm not the only one who's benefited from Sue Grafton's wisdom. So,
okay, so you had this scene that you wrote way in advance that is near the end of the book. I don't know what scene that is. I could guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm assuming it takes place in Alaska.
Yes. Yes,
okay,
that
so
scene does.
We've got to get this to Alaska somehow. How did you make that progression in your mind? How did that work for you? Because they stop somewhere along the way that's mm-hmm. very important.
Yes, they do. Well, I knew I wanted it set in September and October at the beginning of her senior year because I wanted her to kind of come to terms with her own dreams and be able to then later follow through after she left high school. So I had a very specific time frame in mind. And I wanted it to be very realistic. You know, there was no highway system in 1953. I couldn't just pop her in the car and send her, you know, across the country. So I did a lot of research. And luckily for my story's purposes, there was already an Alaskan highway in place, not highway like we think of highway. It was gravel, but put in place right after World War II, and it had just opened up to civilians. So actually, once they're in Alaska, it's a pretty straightforward shot to where they need to go. Getting them to Alaska is more of a challenge. So I just went on eBay every day until I found a 1953 road atlas, and I jumped on that road atlas as soon as there was an authentic 1953 road atlas available. And once it came to my house, I got out my magnifying glass and I tracked that they, everywhere they go, they really could have gone and really are stops because I traced it in the road atlas. And then I found a website that I can't remember right now, but that has weather data going way back. So I also tracked what was the weather on that day in 1953 if they were in, you know, Indiana, if they were in Montana.
Wow, you're hardcore.
I was hardcore, yes. So what they experienced really happened, could have happened on that day and would have been in that place in 1953.
So how much did the road atlas on eBay set you back?
Oh, you know, probably a good 40, 50
did
bucks.
It?
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised because I thought I would hop on eBay and there would be a bunch of old road atlases. Mm-hmm. And there are, but I wanted a 1953 road atlas that she could have gone to the gas station and picked up.
Sure.
Yeah.
That was before President Eisenhower got all those interstate highways
That's
built.
Right.
The book is My One Square Inch of Alaska. Sharon Short wrote it. She joins us on the program today. I'm sure you hear this a lot because I hear it a lot. And you're involved in a writer's workshop. All I do is read books, but I hear this question a lot. Mm-hmm. How do I get a book deal? Don't you hear that a lot?
I do hear that a lot. I had, like you mentioned earlier, I had written mystery novels, and I made a lot of connections through the mystery world. But when the final mystery novel in my Josie series had wrapped up, it was because the publisher had decided that they weren't going to do cozies for not just me, but for other, you know, writers as well. And at the same time, my agent decided that she wasn't going to represent fiction. So I found myself without an editor and without an agent, but with this idea. And I thought, you know, writing is tightrope walking without a net. You do it because you feel compelled to cross from A to B for some reason. And so I sat down and I wrote this whole book with no agent, no editor, no deal anywhere. And when I finished it, I did what every writer does. I started talking with people. And, you know, I had a lot more connections by then. But I chatted with people and said, you know, I wrote this and I think it deserves a shot. And would you read a few pages? And if you like it, would you recommend me to an agent, you know, your agent? And these were people I knew. And they did that. And I had several agents interested and picked the one that I felt got it the most. And it was a good choice, obviously. But I think, you know, really what you do is you go and you network and you talk with people. But it's really important to be very genuine. I would never ask somebody that I didn't genuinely like and know for that kind of favor, you know. Uh-huh. So I think that's important. I think going to writers' workshops, whether it's the one here or, you know, there are all kinds of writers' workshops, is very important. And I think, you know, reading about the industry is really important. I have to admit, I get a little frustrated when I get that question, especially via email, because I feel as though, you know, sit down, run a search on Google and find some of the resources and start reading and learning about, you know, the guides to agents, the guides to getting published.
Do you feel like the doctor at the cocktail party when they come up and they say, yeah, I've got this pain in my...
Yeah.
You feel like that?
A little bit, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But I like to encourage writers, I will say that, because it's a tough path.
Well, I get it all the time, and I'm sure you get it way more than I do, where they say, I have this manuscript. What do I do now? What do I do next? Will you read it? And I do read some of them.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, yeah, because there's some good stuff out there.
Oh,
in fact,
yeah.
I just read one recently that I think could be a huge book. And
this
person doesn't have an agent, mm-hmm. and is just wondering, trying to figure out what to do. Do you have to have an agent? I mean, is that really, like, crucial?
I'm nodding my head, enthusiastically. Yes, it is. And what they should do is they should go to workshops, and they should do agent pitches, and they should query. They should read Writer's Digest or The Writer about how to write a query letter, and they should send out 10 at a time. And when one agent says no, go to the next one on the list so that you've always got a batch out there at, you know, a bunch at a time. If you don't have connections, that's the way people do it. I just did an interview with a local writer named Mindy Arnett, who has a young adult's fantasy novel coming out. And that's exactly what she did. She didn't know anyone. So she finished her book and she found, you know, a list of agents who are interested in young adult fantasy. And that's the important thing, too, is to pick an agent who's going to be interested in what you've written. You know, so I've written a literary novel, so it would be silly for me to query somebody who's focused on cookbooks. There's nothing wrong with selling cookbooks, but I didn't write a cookbook. So she sent out, you know, 10 at a time until one said, yes, I'd like to take a look. And that's how she did it. So...
Sharon Short is my guest on the program today. Her new novel is My One Square Inch of Alaska. And we have a lot of writers in our area here, and I'm sure that you know most of them.
I do know of quite a few.
And a lot of them have been on this program. Mm-hmm. And I see that you've gotten some plugs from some of them. I see Katrina Kittle gave you a nice plug.
Yes.
What's this community of writers like around here? What's your sense of it?
Well, first of all, it's... it is a large community of writers. There are all kinds of writers. We have poets, we have sci-fi writers, we have mystery writers, we have writers like Katrina who write in the literary world and also write young adult. I haven't met a writer here that I felt I didn't like, to tell you the truth. You know, everyone I've met has been so warm with me and with each other and encouraging. And every writer that, you know, I talk with, whether it's Katrina Kittle, Martha Moody, Christina McBride, Tim Wagner, I mean, I could keep going for five more minutes with names. All these folks are really enthusiastic about and passionate about the writing life and about telling a story, and are grateful about connecting with readers. I mean, it's, to me, it's a real honor that somebody wants to sit down and spend 2 or 3 hours with something I've written and read it. They don't have to do that. There are plenty of other things readers could do, but to choose to read my story and to, you know, especially then if a reader gets back to me about it, I think that's just really amazing. And I think most of the writers I know feel that way. So it's a really warm and embracing community. We talk about community a lot at the Antioch Writers Workshop, but it's really true. I mean, it sounds a little like, oh, sweet and corny, but it's really true. Hmm. You know, we're really a community of writers around here.
My favorite character in My One Square Inch of Alaska is Will. And it's because he's such an innocent.
He is. I love Will.
I mean, how could you ever dislike a kid like this? And he reminds me of a lot of kids from back in that day and today. Just that kid just going through life with the bright eyes and the ambition and the sense of wonder.
Yes. And I wanted to capture that in him. And he is. He's sort of, he's funny and he's goofy and he, but he's wise. I mean, he knows. There is a scene where his wisdom kind of comes forth with his big sister about
where she tries to feed him a line of bull.
Yeah, she tries that a couple times and he does not accept it because he sees the truth about his situation and he sees the truth about what she needs to do in life. And he sees the truth that I think sometimes it's easy to forget as we become adults that, you know, life is really about simply going out and embracing it and living it, you know, whether, you know, it's challenging or not. Just go out and embrace and enjoy life. And that's what Will is all about. I do love Will.
Well, that is my favorite scene in the story. And I think it's the culmination of the story. And I see we've reached the culmination of our time on the radio.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Sharon Short. Her new novel is My One Square Inch of Alaska, and it's got a wonderful cover. Have you seen the cover out there? If you haven't seen the cover, go look at the cover.
It is beautiful.
Did you do the cover? Did you have some input into it?
I had a little bit of input in the sense of a few tweaks, but no, the publisher, Penguin Plume, who's a wonderful publisher, coordinated having the artwork done, and they did a fantastic job. I'm one of the authors in the world who cannot complain about my cover.
Well, thanks for coming out.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO, and my guest today in the studio was Sharon Short. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.